So welcome, everyone, to this full house. It's really impressive. Everyone came out on a warm Thursday night to discuss this issue of parole. Really pleased to chair this session and to introduce the speakers tonight. My name is Meredith Rosner. I'm a criminologist here at the LSE and the co-director of the Mannheim Center for Criminology. Mannheim and the Howard League work together to organize these what-if events once or twice a year, a couple times a year. A little bit of information about the what-if if you haven't attended one of our events before. We work in partnership to produce a pamphlet on a series of challenging ideas, ways to challenge conventional thinking on penal issues or justice issues. We work with established and well-thought-of writers, thinkers, academics, practitioners to develop innovative and perhaps controversial, hopefully the point is to be controversial, ideas that can work as a stimulus to new policy initiatives and ultimately to achieve change. So the ultimate goal of tonight is that a pamphlet will be produced, but prior to that, our speakers will have the opportunity to test out their ideas and to engage in a debate and to hear from you guys some comments and questions to help improve the pamphlet. So think of tonight as a sort of peer review, a chance for the author, in this case Nikki Padfield, to subject her ideas to the respondents and to all of you, with this scrutiny allowing her to improve the pamphlet that will ultimately be published. The Howard League and the Mannheim Center organize such events roughly twice a year. If you have, we're constantly on the lookout for new ideas, so if you are especially keen to have an event on a specific topic, we do encourage you to get in touch with Anita Dockley, the research director of the Howard League. You can find her email address on the Howard League website. If you're tweeting tonight, which some of you may be doing, please use the hashtag WhatIf. I will say that tonight's event will be recorded and podcasted, so that means that when it's time for question and answer, there's roving mics, and we do ask you to be able to speak in the microphone. To introduce our speakers for tonight, really pleased to introduce all of you to Nikki Padfield. Nikki is the Master of Fitzwilliams College at Cambridge University and a reader in criminal and penal justice in the law faculty. She sat as a recorder part-time in the Crown Court from 2002 to 2014 and is a bencher of the Middle Temple and served as the university advocate for several years. Nikki's books include The Criminal Justice Process, Texts and Materials, The Criminal Law, and Beyond the Tariff, Human Rights and the Release of Life Sentence Prisoners, so she knows what she's talking about. Whilst maintaining a wide academic lens, her recent research has explored how release from and recall to prison works in practice and how it's perceived by offenders and those who work in the system. This is what we'll be hearing about tonight. This under-researched area provides an important contribution to the understanding of how offenders are best supported in their attempts to desist from criminal lifestyles and how the rehabilitation and resettlement of offenders can be better encouraged. She's an active member of the Pan-European Research Networks, writes the monthly editorial in the Criminal Law Review, and is a member of the Howard League's Research Advisory Group. So Nikki's going to give a 30-minute talk this evening, and then she'll have two respondents. Each respondent will speak for about 15 minutes. First, we'll be hearing from Professor Nick Hardwick. Nick Hardwick became the chair of the Parole Board in March 2016. He's also has a part-time role as professor in criminal justice at the School of Law, the Royal Holloway University in London. From 2010 to 2016, he was HM Chief Inspector of Prisons, and from 2003 to 2010 was the first chair of the Independent Police Complaints Commission. The first half of his career was in the voluntary sector, working with young offenders from NACRO, with young homeless people for Centrepoint, and refugees and asylum seekers for the Refugee Council. He's a voluntary chair of the New Horizon Youth Center and a trustee of Prisoners Abroad. Our other respondent is Dr. Laura Janes. Laura is the Howard League for Penal Reform's legal director. She is a solicitor with higher rights in the civil courts. Laura has developed an expertise in advising and representing children and young people in penal detention in relation to penal law, in relation to prison law, public law, and criminal appeals matters. She was named the lawyer to watch by The Guardian in 2012. She's still a lawyer to watch in 2017. And Laura represents the Howard League for Penal Reform on the Executive Committee of the Association of Prison Lawyers. She has a professional doctorate in youth justice, and she's also a board member of the Legal Action Group. So we're not fooling around with our speakers tonight. As I said, Mickey will have about 30 minutes to speak, followed by 15 minutes for each respondent to respond, and Ben will open it up to the floor for about 25 minutes of question and discussion. I will be keeping you to time because we want to make sure that we can fit everything in tonight. So with that, let me welcome Mickey Padfield.
And we'll move out to that one.
Thank you very much.
Being able to see, we're just going to...
We decided we didn't want to have words written across our faces. Thank you all for coming this evening. It's a wonderful opportunity to come and explore a subject which is very dear to my heart with an audience which is clearly interested, otherwise you wouldn't be here in the first place. It's obviously a really interesting time to think about parole in England and Wales. It's the 50th birthday of the Parole Board, in some senses, Criminal Justice Act 67, when the Parole Board was set up, and there's no time like the present as a good time to review what it was set up to do and what it is doing. It's changed enormously over the years. The size of the Parole Board has changed out of all recognition. The statutory provisions still say that the board should have 5 members. It requires it to have 5 members, but there are over 300, I think.
250.
I got halfway through counting because I wasn't quite sure. Only 250, right? 250, but it's a big difference to 5. The role has changed fantastically from being an advisory body to ministers, particularly whether people should come out after 1/3 determinate sentences. Now the Parole Board is very much focused on, the priority is on the release of lifers, indeterminate sentences, including IPPs, and the growing number of recalled prisoners. And practice has, of course, changed enormously over the last 50 years. What ways in particular? Well, one way I would say is the move towards oral hearings. In the early days, there weren't oral hearings, so of course prisoners had interviews with a member of the Parole Board, which doesn't happen anymore. And the shift from advisory body to a court-like body has happened largely because governments have been kicked to change the rules by the European Court of Human Rights. And I start there with the question, which is, to what extent is it now court-like? It's certainly not a court. It is in some ways court-like. And as importantly, I think, does it matter whether or not it is court-like? I'm very fortunate, very grateful to the Parole Board that they allowed me in the last year to come and do a small amount of research, an exploratory study, as I like to call it, as an excuse for it being small. Last summer I sat in on 19 cases listed for hearing at the Parole Board's hub. The Parole Board very oddly sits within the Ministry of Justice. I observed 15 cases. Sadly, one didn't happen because the prisoner absconded the night before. That's a sad story, I think, in itself. 3 hearings deferred immediately before the hearings. January and March this year, I went back and went to, I think, 11 different prisons to see in prisons 17 different cases. And the earlier project, I was able to talk to a lot of Parole Board members, to whom I'm very grateful. More recently, I was able also to talk to prisoners and lawyers and offender managers and so on. Nothing's yet published from that. I've written 2 dense reports for the Parole Board, examination coming later on for members of the Parole Board who's read it. But now they have let me off my leash and I'm busy writing for publication and indeed talking now. I have long been interested in the subject, and if you wanted to know partly what I thought, I've done a little bit of plug there for something. If you put Padfield Understanding Recall 2011, it comes straight up on the net, and I think that's quite a good background to some of the things I'm going to say. Part of the background that one has to talk about in this context is the challenge of long sentences and the growing length of sentences. I'm not going to take you through that. You can read that if you want. Delighted to send any of you the PowerPoint presentation if anyone wants it. Email me nmp21@cam.ac, but the basic message is that, as you probably all know, sentences are getting longer. Living long sentences is really difficult, and I do a plug at the bottom of that slide to Ben Crewe and his colleagues' recent article on swimming with the tide, adapting to long-term imprisonment. I think it's a really interesting article, and it raises fundamental questions about how you judge somebody who's been in prison for a long time on their fitness to be released, which has to be another of our fundamental questions. I thought it was appropriate to divert very briefly onto whole life sentences, because there are 70 plus people in England and Wales who will not be going before the parole board, and I thought that the decision in Hutchinson and the UK was enormously disappointing in terms of the European Court of Human Rights getting very wimpy, being a little bit bullied by the Court of Appeal and deciding that, oh, well, everything was all right, okay, in England and Wales. And my hero of the moment is the dissenting judge, Pinto de Albuquerque. His judgment is amazing in its damnation of the games that the British Supreme Court plays, but also the European Court of Human Rights itself. Small quotation there, the majority's decision in saying our whole life sentence system is okay. It represents a peak in a growing trend towards downgrading the role of the court before certain domestic bullying jurisdictions like England comes up with various good examples, with the serious risk that the convention is applied with double standards. And it's a, I think, very convincing argument. So I thought it was worth reminding us all that the whole life sentence prisoners will not go before the parole board. For all the other lifers and indeterminate sentences who I'm mostly interested in this evening, they're governed by the generic parole process. In fact, there's a very bizarre, I think, hierarchy of laws, strange bits of statute, parole boards reissued every now and then, parole board rules 2016. You find most of it in prison service instructions or whatever. But the basic rule is that the system is run from the prison service, which I think is another very odd thing when we're trying to rethink parole. Public protection casework section in, what used to be NOMS, the Her Majesty's Prisons and Probation Service, starts off the process, creates the dossier, tells the prisoner that it's starting, and off you go into a 26-week process. There's an irony here. 26 weeks is quite good, and they're actually rather efficient at getting reports out of people, which means by the time the hearing comes on, the reports are out of date, and you have to get update reports. And that's not unproblematic. It's not just, of course, the decisions of PPCS which count at this early stage in hearings. The parole board has struggled over the years with court rulings saying they've got to have oral hearings, because from the parole board's point of view is oral hearings are really expensive, and if the prisoner doesn't want it, or if they're definitely not going to come out anyhow, is it a waste of time? We can go back through the history if you want, but since I was only given 30 minutes, I'm not going to give a detailed history lesson. But Smith and West oral hearings, and then Osborne and Booth, Supreme Court building on this jurisprudence from the European Court of Human Rights, saying, yes, you've got to have oral hearings, but still the parole board saying, well, the delays will get worse if everybody has an oral hearing because we're not resourced to do this. So currently they have what's called the MCA process, where a single member of the parole board decides whether there should be an oral hearing. There's an appeal against it. That, again, is a process that I haven't looked at in any depth, and I hope that somebody will, because clearly MCA members vary in their decision-making, in their risk aversion, and they do it on their own. It's obviously an area to think about. The dossiers are absolutely intriguing. They, in my very small study, they were between 132 and 666 pages long. Only the prisoner nowadays necessarily gets them in paper copy, because the parole board has been persuaded, I think, almost universally to go electronic. That raises some questions, of course, as to whether they are all equipped to digest files, very long files, on their iPads. I think a nice research project would see how people make decisions electronically and how differently they do it when they're not using paper. But the oddest thing in these dossiers is definitely the first, or maybe it's the second page, which is the government ministers' terms of referral to the parole board. So, as I said, PPCS start off the process, and this front page of the dossier says, don't forget, parole board, you can only direct release or recommend that a prisoner moves to open conditions, and we don't have to follow that if we don't want to, and we don't want you to do anything else. And this is a quotation from what it says. In any event, the board is not being asked to comment or to make any recommendation about the security classification of the closed prison in which the prisoner may be detained, nor any specific treatment needs or offending behaviour required, nor on the date of the next review. To which I say simply, why not? You put this expert court-like body together, why don't you want them to give you any other useful information? Why don't you want to use their expertise? Why are they focused on one issue? Probably to a majority of the parole board, it's quite comforting. That's all they have to do. They know they're focused on risk, making the decision that they have to make. But it does seem to me to be very odd. There are lots of things we could discuss about dossiers, how report writers will have read other people's reports beforehand, how stories get built up by repetition, but I'm not going to say anything about that, or indeed about the details of risk management plans. Hearings. I was very lucky. By the time I got to the prisons, the board was happy for me to sit in their pre-hearing decisions. I don't have much I want to say tonight about that. Obviously, the panel gets together before the hearing and discusses what they think are the key risk areas, the order in which they're going to ask questions, which witnesses they're going to have in which order, and who's going to ask which questions of whom. Again, I think there's a lot of further research could be done about the order and how it's done, the extent to which it's inquisitorial and so on. Normally, just in my study, the most frequent is what I heard called rather oddly quite often the offender sandwich, that you start with the offender supervisor, the person who knows the person who works in the prison where the offender is, where the prisoner is the offender supervisor. Then they'll hear from the prisoner, and then finally end up with the offender manager, the probation officer in the community. But actually, the order is rearranged quite often, because people will say that actually, let's hear from the prisoner first before he's heard the words of the other people, and we'll just parrot what they say, or let's have the offender last because we want to. So there's interesting discussion, and it must have some impact, I should think, but I couldn't say what it was. The role of the lawyer, I think, is really, really interesting. the best lawyers before the parole board are those who best understand that the prisoner has got to talk their way out of prison rather than have an over-talkative lawyer who thinks that they can do it for them. There are obviously huge issues, just as there is about legal advice in the police station, about whether the advice or support you have at the hearing is the most important thing. Actually, it's the advice much earlier on, and I would argue strongly for much better legal advice for prisoners throughout their sentence. We've had that recent wonderful decision that legal aid's now going to be available for pre-tariff hearings. It's very welcome, but as far as I'm concerned, it's a tip of the iceberg. So hearings are hearings, decision-making is decision-making. They reach their decisions quite quickly, but I put a question mark there because actually the most shocking thing to me of my small research that I've just done is how many cases didn't get decided on the day of the hearing. Even when they've started, 10 of 18 of the video hearings were deferred or adjourned on the day, and if you look at the parole board statistic, that's not very untypical. There is, I'm sure Nick will refer to it in his talk, a real problem of deferments, adjournments for all sorts of reasons. I mention here the decision letters. Decision letters are very odd. The prisoner gets something which is half judgment, half letter, and very soon afterwards gets something from PPCS which is in a slightly different style, saying not dissimilar things. I think, again, we could do quite a lot of thinking about why the decision letters are as they are. I've put here a little bit on prisoners' views because I wanted to have their voices here. I think my strongest sense from the prisoners that I talked to and the hearings that I observed was the overwhelming sense, really, of the prisoners' powerlessness in the process. They were powerless in the face of what could often feel like irrational justice, deferrals or adjournments, not being kept in the picture, not knowing what was going to happen. And interestingly for me, as this out-of-touch ivory tower academic that I try not to be, they weren't as cross as I was sometimes because they don't expect very much. Their expectations of the system were very low. And indeed, I met some offender supervisors who were crosser than the prisoners about some of the decisions. So I think there is something quite difficult to get our brains around about how resigned to a lousy system people can become. I like the quote at the end, it's like one cog in a gearbox. Once it all starts to fall to bits, the whole thing starts to fall to bits. But there are one or two hints in the middle of that slide too. The real problem of changes in staff. Luck plays such a large part in this as to whether you've ever met your OM and whether what happens. I think they tell you to cultivate a good relationship, but some don't even write back to you when you write to them. It's impossible to cultivate a good relationship. There are lots of problems for communicating from the prisoner's point of view. The outcomes of my cases, I think, aren't actually very interesting because I was just looking at one snapshot, one moment, and actually you need to follow the cases through. So two prisoners were released from the video hearings. Is that a lot or is it a little number? It looks a bit like a little number. Could they have been released sooner, those ones? Could they have been released later? Somebody needs to do some serious research, more longitudinally studying parole board decision-making over prisoners' careers to work out what's going on in terms of release. But as I've put in bold here, the astonishing thing to me, the number of cases which were deferred on the day or adjourned on the day, which is when everybody's all wound up to be there. Indeed, the parole board has got either to the hub in London or to the prisoner's prison, and something goes wrong. And the parole board is desperately aware of this and desperately keen to cut their problems here. To move for a minute to what do we know about desistance from crime a little bit on the academic side, if I may. What do we know about what helps people not reoffend? This is a summary of bullet points. Many of you will have been to Tony Bottom's lectures, Fergus Neal's lectures. Those I've plagiarised happily from anyone whose summaries I like. But the piece of writing that I like at the moment is this wonderful piece by Mark Halsey and colleagues Ruth Armstrong and Serena Wright, Fuck It, Madsen and the Mood of Fatalism in the Desistance Process. And they talk a lot about fuck it moments. Why people reoffend is it's just so difficult going straight on such limited resources, and things go wrong and you just have what they call a fuck it moment. And to me, that speaks quite clearly of the problem of working out who's going to face these future terrible moments is unpredictable when you're sitting, or largely unpredictable when you're sitting in the parole board making a decision, because so much may or may not go wrong or right in the prisoner's time once they're released. It's really difficult to anticipate it, I think. So they talk about my last bullet point there, the need for understanding, support and pro-social relationships, the lack of effective channels for resolving difficulties. A lot of what we know about desistance as a really difficult process, I think, should help us rethink parole in ways which I'll get to in a moment. My interest initially with this research with the parole board was thinking, well, why are they so cautious? Why are so few people coming out? But actually, it's very difficult to say too cautious, because what is your measure? Certainly, different parole board members have different appetites for risk. That's human nature. And I think we can worry about that. But actually, the barriers to release are much, much more obvious than simply parole board decision making. Weak release plans. The role of the offender manager is really interesting. Some clearly don't think that he's ready to come out, so they don't prepare a very good release plan. Well, he's not going to be released if there's not a very good release plan. Some misunderstand, I think, the extent to which the parole board needs convincing. Well, I knew he was ready for release. Why didn't they believe me? Well, you weren't a very convincing offender manager by the way you presented it, so there's lots of interesting things there. Lots of real practical problems for offender managers in preparing release plans. Accommodation issues, absolutely in your face. Impossibly difficult often finding accommodation for lifers or IPPers, and they're not coming out if there's not somewhere where they can go and live which convinces the parole board. Prison behaviour, a complete nightmare. How you prove it's safe to release you when you're in prison, it's a really, really difficult issue. Offender supervisors felt to me rather powerless in the process. People got an offender manager out there who they don't have much to do with. The offender supervisors were often very engaged. They had much more to do with the prisoners, but they're not in charge. They didn't feel that they could drive it on. So there were lots of issues in relation to cultural delay, lack of authority. Could the parole board shake the system? Is the parole board in a position to shake the system? Are they looking at the right factors? The culture of delay, I think, is an issue that we have to think about. It is a bureaucratic process, and people get used to delays. People get used to inertia. The parole board isn't really, I think, empowered to do everything that I would like it to be able to do. I've quoted the National Audit Office report this year there, about the oldest of the outstanding cases in September 2016 had a target date in 2009, with another 404 cases had target dates in 2015. They should have had their hearing in 2015, and by 2016 they still hadn't. My small study, 17 oral hearings in prisons in early 2017, five had been referred 2 years before the oral hearing actually took place. So there are delays for all sorts of reasons, and why I think this is a fun, if you like, opportunity to rethink parole, it's to get us to think about how do we encourage the system to be more urgent. What can we do to create that sense of urgency? The next slide mentions the role of luck. Luck, I think, is a huge problem. I've had a very lucky life. I don't know about you. Luck plays a large part in all of our lives. And luck is an enormous part of the parole process. Whether you have an offender manager who is really, really engaged in championing your progress or whatever. And it's a problem, the role of luck, I think. Academics get very excited about legitimacy, and I think there is a lot to be explored in relation to legitimacy here. Not only does it leave people to be disaffected, but not only does it leave people to be dissatisfied, a bit grumpy, but it actually switches them off in various ways. So I want to move away from offender management to offender progress. The law is undoubtedly a barrier to release. The law says the parole board shan't release them unless. People within the parole board are slightly uncertain as to whether there is a burden of proof on one side or the other, but it seems to me in your face obvious that rules should change. The first declaration of incompatibility after the Human Rights Act was passed in 1998 was about the burden of proof before mental health review tribunals. And it seems to me that the first change that should happen is a clear burden of proof on the state to justify post-tariff detention for lifers. More difficult might be working out whether you want the threshold for release to be lowered. I certainly think the longer you are post-tariff, the more certain the board should have to be that you need to be detained. And of course, we could say a lot of these IPPs are serving dreadfully short tariffs, and they've been in for a long time post-tariff. So why not a rule which says once you've done twice your tariff, you come out? It seems to me that that would be a rather good rule. I went straight from England and Wales back to look in France, and it is really interesting, the status of the parole board. The governing governor of the prison where I was came and greeted the parole board whenever they came to the French prison. I don't think in the prisons where I was, and somebody can tell me if I'm wrong, but I don't think the governing governor really knew the parole board was coming into their prison today. They weren't taken nearly as seriously as the visiting JEP, the juge d'application de peine in France. And the French judiciary are much more involved in the implementation of sentencing. I've been to Scotland recently. That was an interesting visit. Why do we English lawyers not look at Scotland more often? Parole board's much more of a tribunal. It's always chaired by a lawyer, and the prison staff I talked to thought that was a good idea, which was interesting, but I've only got it there with a question mark. They're different. They're also very similar, of course, the last two bullet points. They've got this huge problem that we have of a growing number of recalled prisoners, ex-prisoners facing exactly the same challenges, accommodation, drugs, alcohol, back to prison, down the Snakes and Ladders board, and they have just the same problems of adjournments. So what are we going to do? We've got to think about what the parole board is for, and if it's worth having, then we should strengthen it significantly. Nick knows that I was always rather annoyed in my little bit of research that they have this logo very dominant everywhere saying, parole board, working with others to protect the public. And I don't think that's the message at all. So if we're rethinking parole, let's start off by saying, parole board, working independently to protect the rights of prisoners and the public or something. Get the protection of the rights of prisoners in there as well as with the public. Change some of the process issues, as I've already suggested. Give much, much better support and advice to prisoners. But actually, the parole board is the tip of the iceberg. a different lecture that I might be giving would be rethinking the prison system. And I would definitely want to argue that prisons and probation have got this ridiculous line between them, the silos that Lord Carter identified decades ago. Well, NOMS didn't solve the problem and HMPPS won't solve the problem. Many of our prisons are simply a disgrace, as is the size of the prison population, and you'll all know that I'm not alone in saying that. The current Chief Inspector of Prisons says that our prisons are unacceptably violent and dangerous places. Well, how can the parole board do a good job in that context? Huge problems in relation to who this prisoner population is. Let's move on to worrying about what prisons are for. I think there are very fundamental questions we've got to think. Yes, prisons are necessary. They have an incapacitative function. We haven't had enough imagination as a society to develop adequate alternatives, adequate punitive alternatives, if you like. But people should not be in prison for reform, rehabilitation, or even, I would say, for deterrent purposes. For the people who are in prison, the people who are going to remain in prison, we've got to have a very genuine policy which tries to equip them to be released as quickly as possible. Post-custody supervision has got to prioritise support, encouragement. Recall to prison should always be seen as a failure, not a success. It's not a success recalling somebody back to prison. But my question, which, I want to ask all of you, is how do we effect that change? I am merely an academic, if you like. I suspect that many of you would want to say that my proposals are very, very minor. Well, they are minor, but I think that you have to be a bit realistic if you actually want it to change. I could come up with a much bolder argument for change, but I think nudging an improvement is what we need. So let's change the burden of proof and really worry about the state of prisons today. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Next up, we have Nick.
Good evening. I feel rather guilty. I haven't done a PowerPoint, but perhaps you're all PowerPointed. You get enough of those, perhaps. It's a real pleasure to be here and speaking to another Howard League audience. One of the criticisms or questions that I think Nikki could have asked about the parole board is that if it's a court-like body, why are all its hearings held behind closed door with no opportunity for people to see what's going on? I think that would be a legitimate question myself. Now, in practical terms, the difficulties of getting people into a prison or the prisoner out and what that might do to the victim and the prisoner would be pretty immense. But it's a question worth asking. But in the meantime, what we've tried to do over the last few months is open the parole board up in other ways. So hence, it was really good that Nikki was able to come in and do her research. We've encouraged other researchers to come in. We're trying to get journalists, trying to wade through the treacle of the MOJ to get journalists in to do some fly-on-the-wall documentaries about it. And we encourage observers to come in with the agreement of the prisoner and the victim to attend and observe kind of what we do. So I think it's... So I welcome what the work that Nikki's done and that she's able to come in and have a look at what we do. And I have to say, very little of what she said that I disagree with, actually. So it would be a bit tedious if I was here this evening and just went, I agree with Nikki. So I won't do that. And of course, I don't need to say, you know, I think I've said before to this sort of audience what my concerns are about the kind of prison system. And to summarise, I think, you know, as I've said before, I was always really pleased to get out of a prison. I think if anyone thinks that being in prison is not a very, very harsh punishment, even in the best run prison, then they are fooling themselves. And so it's important, it seems to me, that we only have people in prison when it's absolutely necessary they should be there. And I won't rehearse that argument, in which I'm sure there's a reasonable consensus. But what I thought I would talk about in my 50 minutes is some of the things I think Nikki doesn't cover that I think are worthy of consideration in this context. Yeah? And the first of those, which I think you only gets touched on briefly, and I often in audiences like this don't get touched enough, which is the kind of duty to protect, certainly for the parole board, the duty to protect the public, and what concern should we give to the victims of the crimes in this process. And I think, I've said this to these sorts of audiences before. I think unless those people who are interested in prison reform can develop a narrative that addresses the legitimate concerns of people who are the victims of crime, then it's too easy to dismiss our arguments. I don't even like... I think even the word victims is a bit like when people talk about offenders as a group. I'm not particularly comfortable with it, but I use it as a kind of shorthand. And I said, I went on Saturday up to South Shields to talk to a conference of the National Victims Association about parole. And I think, you know, they were pretty pleased I'd kind of turned up, just because no one does come and listen to them and hear what they've got to say. And I think, you know, my experience of these groups is always much more reasonable than you would expect, given kind of what's happened to them. These were all just a group of people, all of whom had a close family member murdered. Right? And when they spoke, you have these sort of cries of anguish, really. And what was really striking is how much it echoed what I'd just been hearing on the television from the victims in the Grenfell Tower thing. So it's nobody listens to us. We're stuck with no, you know, our loved one has died, the person who earned the money here, how are we going to pay the rent, where are we going to live, we're having our benefits stopped, no one's explaining the process, we don't have a voice, we can't get legal aid, etc., etc., right? And they talked, they used the same terminology of no peace, no justice, as you had coming from some of the people in Grenfell Tower. And it would be hypocritical if I sort of said one thing to them and something different to you. So I won't. I think they had legitimate concerns that we need to take seriously. So when we talk about risk, I think it's important we don't talk in abstractions. Right? It's easy to talk about risk when we're not, when you're not the person. I don't think it's easy. But we need to think about risk is what might be faced with a panel of parole members sitting there with an offender who's had a victim, thinking about the victim. So in a domestic violence case, for instance, when offenders or prisoners have a record of domestic violence offences, you know, risk means what level of risk are we prepared to accept that this guy's going to go out and hurt or mutilate or batter another woman? Yeah? You know? Is he's probably not going to do it, okay? He might do it. Is that okay? Or we're really confident he won't. And when you start to talk about risk in the language of you know, not the legal language, not parole board language, away from that, those are the dilemmas that face people. And I think unless we can... that should be factored into our... thinking about reform to the parole system, unless we can articulate a credible response to the questions that I guess most people who wouldn't be in this room would kind of ask us about the pro system, then I think we won't get anywhere pro. So part of my answer to Nikki's point about what do we do to need to make progress, I think we need to have some credible answers to the questions those people would ask about that side of it. And in practice, you know, Nikki mentioned this thing about what would be a measure of success. You know, a quite interesting thing for us is we do monitor the serious further offences that prisoners commit after they've been released by the parole board. We do about 7,000 cases a year, and maybe a dozen or 20 people commit a serious further offence. Sometimes that'll be a murder, sometimes that will be a rape, a violent assault. Now that's less than 1%, a lot less than 1%. So you could look at that figure, couldn't you, in two different ways. You could say, well, actually, maybe that means they're being over-cautious if it's that level. Or you could say, you know, because it'll happen in the spread evenly over the year, that's a terrible, you know, that's the problem with not doing its job properly. And the one thing where I would disagree with Nick, one of the few things where I disagree, I'm cautious about the word urgency, actually. I do want board members to be cautious and careful. I don't want them to rush. I do want them to be careful. And I think we have to be... And I put these things forward for discussion, actually. But if you aren't, that is a part of the argument that we need to have and we need to think about, I would say. And then the second area to talk about is the... The pro board itself, and I certainly wouldn't argue with any of the descriptions of problems that the pro board has got that Nikki mentioned. And on the question of independence, you know, I don't think we should be in the Ministry of Justice building. I heard today, I hadn't realised it actually. I can tell you all a secret, right? I hadn't realised this actually. Apparently, we have a disguised address. I hadn't kind of worked that out, so I address on a letterhead. So it's 57 Queen Anne's Gate or something. So people don't know we're in the Ministry of Justice building. This is only just, I hadn't realised that before. But there you are. So we're embarrassed by it, and so we should be. But to be frank, I'll tell you that personally, in terms of my list of priorities, don't want to stop dealing with cases while we organise an office move and argue the Home Office. I want to get some other stuff sorted out first to be sort of clear about that, I think. And I think there is a real dilemma, it seems to me, about how that sort of desire to shape the system, all the stuff that's coming to us and make that work better, fits with the notion of independence. And I think that's quite a tricky, you know, if we are running the system as a whole, in a sense you're getting into the preparation of the cases that come before us, then are we, you know, to what, if we are saying what course somebody should do, that I would argue starts to raise some interesting questions about your independence when it comes to assessing a prisoner who's done the course that you ordered. Right? Now I'm not saying actually what's happening, our welcome pro board members are pushing those boundaries and they are doing that despite their instruction. But again, I don't think that's a simple binary question. I think there's dilemmas in that about the sort of purity of your independence, about the as opposed to the desire to get hold of this dysfunctional system and try and make it work a bit better. And then I'll say about the pro board, I think another important thing to... I would say, start from the position, I absolutely accept the criticisms that are made of it. In 5 minutes, I'll do it. I won't be more than 5 minutes. Right? But there are some things I think that are worth looking to. Certainly, like our backlogs and waiting times are coming down, not fast enough, but they are coming down, so we are making progress. And some other figures I looked at the other day, which I hadn't kind of realised, and I'd be interested about whether people in this audience know this. So I'd exclude the people on our various user groups or whatever who we might have told these figures to do. But if I was to ask you, on the basis of what you've heard, say for IPP prisoners, what do you think is the release or progression rate? So what proportion of the people do we see do we release or move to open conditions, would you say, from what you've heard? Have a guess. Someone. Bold. Helen, there you are. I'm going to pick on you. Have a guess.
20%?
13%. 75. didn't know that, did you? 75% this year of the people who've, IPPs, who come before the parole board, have either been moved to open conditions or released.
How many IPPs?
IPPs, IPPs.
How many? What's the size?
Out of, I can tell you the, I can tell you the number, out of the, I can't tell you the number of IPPs we saw, I can't tell you the number of IPPs that we saw this year, but of the IPPs, and the number of IPPs is coming down, and the numbers of people who are more than 90 days from their, delays of more than 90 days are coming down too. Now, I say that, this is quite an important figure. Right? Why this is important, I think, is for two reasons. Because I'll come to another figure that's, I think, very important. Right? One is, if you'd asked me when I started this job, where people did ask me, I thought the risk test and the balance of the risk test was the critical issue. I'm less convinced that's the critical issue now. And I'm not so sure that if you change the risk test, if you reversed it, it would have the effect that everybody thinks it would do, actually. I'm not convinced it would lead to that more releases. I think, though I agree, there are some categories of IPP in particular, those who are way over tariff, particularly those who've done more than this every minute, that you should do something about. But generally, I don't think reversing the risk test will have the effect that that people think it will do in terms of numbers. And secondly, I think there's an issue around be careful about the changes that people want to make the parole board look more efficient, that actually doesn't knock things into reverse rather than take them forward. So it is true, for instance, that the our rate of adjournments and deferrals is too high, but some of those adjournments and deferrals we're sure are now happening because rather than knock a case back, we're holding the case and saying, OK, we'll wait for this report, wait for them to do that thing, and then we're releasing them. So I could tidy my figures up and reduce my deferrals and adjournments rate by releasing less people and giving them a quicker refusal. And that's not what we're doing. So that's not the whole reason for the adjournments and deferrals, but that is a factor within the numbers. Right? I will finish in 1 minute. Right? So I think, right, and I would say, look, this is the despite all the criticisms, I think you find it hard to point to another bit of the criminal justice system where the numbers are going in the right direction. So be careful you don't shove us in a way that knocks us backwards rather than forwards, I would say. Then the third thing, I just want to say this is the important thing. Actually, I'm more and more convinced now that the problem with the parole system is not the parole system. It's what Nikki was talking about, what's happening in the community. If on the other hand, so IPPs, we have a good rate of releasing IPPs, right? The recall rate is 50%. So half of the people we release get knocked back. Right? And that's not often. Now, some of that is for fairly trivial things, but a lot of it is around very difficult behaviour where there is not the resources in the community, the approved premises, the appropriate levels of supervision, we've heard about probation lately, to manage them effectively in the community. Right? And I'm more and more persuaded that the answer to the problems with the parole system don't actually lie with the parole system. They lie with what's happening in the community, about what stops people getting into the system in the first place. But in our case in particular, what's happening about the recall rate, that where the barrier for getting recalled is much too low, the barrier for getting re-released is much too high, and the support that's available is not acceptable. And I will finish. So I would say... So my three questions are around how do we address the legitimate concerns of people who are the victims of crime and have a narrative about this that includes them? How do we make sure that we don't knock the parole board, knock it backwards rather than knock it forwards? And what do we do about the failures in the community that are leading to these unacceptable recall rates? Sorry, I went over time, but I've done that.
Thank you very much. Put your PowerPoint up here.
Yes, it's just on the desktop.
This one.
That one.
Yeah. Doesn't want to open up. It says it's a shortcut. Here's your stick. Apologies.
Okay. Well, am I ready to go?
Yep, yep. Ready. Yep.
Okay. So I'm just going to follow on now with a few real reflections from the practice at the Howard League. So our legal team represents children and young people in custody. So our experiences of parole are all really focused around children and young people. And of course, there are obviously going to be many things that are going to touch on what we've heard already today, so bear with me. But the three things I want to focus on is really just this cultural shift, I think. Not so much, I think I agree with Nick in terms of not necessarily reversing the burden, if indeed there is one, but actually thinking about what we have already in some of the extended sentence cases, having this starting position of a default position being liberty, and that's where we start from. And just as not seeing recall as success, actually seeing release as success, and have everybody galvanising around that concept that that's what we aim to do. The second thing that I want to talk about, again ties in, I think, with what both of you have said very much, is actually a problem-solving approach to getting the best possible risk management together so that the parole board can really make a good risk-based decision in the context of a proper risk management plan. And the third thing, again, sounding very familiar, I think is actually tying in with dealing with that shocking 50% recall rate for IPPs and generally actually for indeterminate, and actually thinking about dealing with the risk of recall, reducing the risk of recall, and we have some ideas about reducing that licence period and thinking about some perhaps greater accountability for recall decisions. So I'm just going to whiz through some of those thoughts, really. Of course, the notion of liberty being a default position is well known to many of us, and it's what happens in extended sentence cases. That's currently the position for the preventative part. Once the punishment period is over, if you're not in that situation where you're thinking, I'm absolutely confident they're risky or they're not risky, but if it's you're really not sure, benefit of the doubt, default position, liberty. And that seems to me a perfectly defensible position to take. And I think it really can make a difference. You know, we always wonder whether these, I think, sitting and watching the Sim case when I was working for Ed Fitzgerald, and it was the first case I ever saw, I think, and I just thought, all these judges sort of going on about, the default position being liberty, what difference? I'd never ever been to a parole board hearing then. What difference would that actually really make? But I think it does. You know, when you're in a parole board hearing, as I was last week, and at the beginning of the hearing, the parole board judge says, I'm independent, this is what I'm looking at, and in fact, our starting point is liberty. That's the default position. The point of this sentence is for you to have a period under supervision in the community. That's what we're looking at. It sets the right tone. And I think that, in a way, that may be preferable to the reversing of this burden idea, because there is a concern about unintended consequences, and the thing that springs to my mind is the opportunity for the state, with all that power and resources behind it, to muster all the evidence against the person to really prove they're a big risk. And actually, I don't think that's particularly helpful and could be pretty damaging. So that's my thought. And of course, I think the idea of this onus, it is absolutely true that in reality it does fall to the prisoner to make the case. And I think it really is a Sisyphean task and, in plain terms, an uphill struggle. So
some of those impossible tasks that prisoners face, and which we've heard about already today. Of course, the frustrations of getting on courses. Unfortunately, that was one of the key areas that our legal aid case didn't manage to address, and so there's no legal aid for that. There's no guarantees now that these courses will make you safe. We all have heard about the sex offender treatment programs that people have been waiting for years to get on, and now are suddenly either being told they have to finish a course that's apparently useless, or not do it at all and wait for some new super duper course that nobody knows what it is to come online. So different approaches, of course, to behaviour in prison. I think, again, something that Nikki touched on earlier. You can just get two completely different approaches. How do you show that one pattern of behaviour in prison is indicative of being safe or risky in the community? And just thinking about two examples that happened, I think, within two cases that I worked on within 2 weeks of each other. The first was a young adult with a very long history of very negative peer influence, but he had done the course that had been identified for him, successfully graduated, he had changed, he no longer wanted to associate with negative peers. He then became, from being the bully, he became a victim of bullying, and he ended up forcing a situation where he ended up in segregation and refused to leave because he didn't feel safe coming out, and he didn't want to associate with negative peers. In that case, he was told that his new skills had been insufficiently tested for release because he ought to have gone back onto main location and handled the bullies and the negative peer influence. The next week, I did a case for a young adult with a long history of peer influence who had completed years in a psychologically informed environment and who had refused the opportunity, who'd gone back to main location, but then refused the opportunity to return to the specialist wing so she could be removed from the negative peers. In that case, she was deemed to have demonstrated insufficient resolve to avoid negative peers. So it's one never knows what's going to work, and I think the answer is it's impossible. So just this thing of seeing release as success, I've already mentioned that. I suppose the prison purposes in the Prison and Courts Bill might have gone some way to helping galvanise the whole system towards thinking about that with the rehabilitative focus, but I'm glad that Nikki thinks we ought to be nudging, because I think that's all we're going to get for the next while, for the next 2 years. So that's, I think, what we should be working on. I also think that one thing that struck me working particularly with children and young people, where I have quite often made a special application and asked the panel to say when it's quite, well, where it seems pretty clear what it might be, to explain their decision to a young person, because that waiting after the parole board decision, waiting sometimes for that letter stroke decision judgment thing to slip under your door, I think is one of the most unbearable things, and then reading it under your door on your own and not understanding it all. But quite often I have asked panels to explain what their decision is, and actually it's one of the most positive things that I've ever experienced in my own legal career, because everyone can see, you know, that the person concerned can react, the person who is making the decision can explain, and I think that's a really positive thing, would help in terms of seeing release as a success. So on to my second sort of thing, this problem-solving approach. As Nick said, there's already quite a lot of bold, very safety-conscious, but bold members willing to be quite robust about getting risk management plans together. Particularly in the children's and young people's cases I've done, we often get superb directions from thoughtful members who really work hard to make sure that professionals are there and are going to turn up with a plan. Often it's a joint effort to ask for the direction, but it's possible. And I think actually learning from each other and possibly even peer review within the parole board to make sure that kind of positive approach would be a very
very good thing. So just an example, recent example of a young adult with very high level of support needs. All professionals believed that risk could only be managed if those needs were met. Successive decisions by the parole board that risk was manageable, each following recalls, not for further offending. Very active case management by the parole board in that case meant that every key witness, including the people who could provide the appropriate support on release, the people that could release the funding for it, were round the table. So when I got up at 5:30 and took the 5:30 train up to do the train, you know, we had nothing. We had no risk management plan. We had no recommendations for release. But by the end of the day, we had a risk management plan, we had a guarantee of funding, and we had a recommendation from the professionals for release. So, and that was, that couldn't have happened if the parole board hadn't actively managed that case and made sure everyone who needed to be there was there. The final thing then, of course, as we've already said, is recall. Once the parole board, in my view, has made a decision to release, you know, you do have this wealth of expertise, you do have this opportunity to really look at everything. And I think once that decision's been made, I think it should be a turning point in the journey and that risk history of the person. So with seeing, it's very frustrating to have all these decisions, the same evidence at every hearing, the same decision being made, and yet it doesn't seep in, doesn't change the way he's being managed in the community. I personally think, and the Howard League have written about this already, that limiting, once you've made that decision, we've really thought about it carefully, this person is, we think, to the best of the information we have, pretty safe, actually limit that period for ISPs on licence to a period of time, enough to give sufficient support and supervision for a period. You can have safeguards. The Secretary of State perhaps could apply if they're very concerned and they think the licence period needs to be longer, but it's for the Secretary of State to say we're concerned. And of course, if there's a new serious offence, the criminal justice system will take its course. But I think that would be a really positive development and would really stop the flow of recalls. I also think poor recall decisions. We've got lots of experience of people being recalled by overnight approved premises staff. When you speak to the offender manager, oh, well, you know, I certainly wouldn't have taken that decision. You know, he was doing really well. Insufficient information. It may not always be a decision that was sort of clear at the time where they did it, but within 24 hours or 3 days, it's clear that it wasn't them. There's CCTV of them in the other part of town or whatever's going on. So I know it's not very fashionable these days, if you make a mistake, to correct it immediately, but I do believe that executive re-release ought to be available for indeterminates. I mean, it seems like a no-brainer to me. And I just wonder, you know, if the parole board do find that a recall was not justified, ought there to be some kind of a right to compensation, you know, perhaps from the budget of the person who made that decisions, just an idea. So my final word then, with 1 minute to go, so I'll slow it down, is to reduce the scope for recall, to increase accountability, and I think thereby try and instill hope for a future crime-free life.
What I'd like to do now is invite Nikki to come back up. She's got 5 minutes to respond. And I'm also going to ask the speakers to come back.
Questions first, and could we end?
Oh, do you want to end?
Yeah, that's fine.
Absolutely, yep. Well, I'll invite you three to come back up, and I'll turn off this machine so that the light's not shining in your eyes. If I can figure out how to do it. So that leaves us with about 15 minutes for questions. I'd like to group the questions in groups of three, and what I'd like to ask you to do is, because we're recording, we've got roving mics roving, so please wait until the microphone is handed to you and briefly introduce yourself.
Let us know if you represent a specific organization, and please keep your questions brief, comments brief. First, we'll hear from you in the front, and then after that, you in the blue shirt there.
And then Catherine Gleeson, it's IP Family Blog. My question is, a lot of the prisoners, because they're over tariff, are suffering from mental health issues, understandably, and why can't we actually release them under medical grounds? That's another thought there. And a lot of the problems, I think, with some of the prisoners, and they start from special measures. That's actually starting from the police station, not getting the special measures because they've got special needs, communication problems. So they're not actually giving the best of statements. And then when they go from there and they're in court, they're not recognised there, so their communication is almost held back, almost looking guilty before they start, because they have to think about everything and process what they're saying. And then they get into the prison system, which then they can't cope with. So, you know, a lot of things have to be sorted, not just in the prisons, but in the, when they first get arrested, so that everyone knows they're able to communicate in the first place. And, you know, some people are guilty just because they weren't able to defend themselves and couldn't actually say what really was the problem. You know, just basically defending themselves, yeah. So, and that goes for people with dyslexia, dyspraxia, Asperger's and autism. I mean, these are hidden disabilities. And when you go into a police station, it's so not obvious. And I've actually sometimes been with a solicitor where he would say, oh, don't tell him that you've got special needs, because they just don't want them to leave the room and, you know, they've wasted their money and their time. Yeah.
Thank you. The next question is from this man in the blue shirt.
Hello. Hi, so I'm Dr. Harry Nesson at Southampton University in the Law School. And I've spent rather more time than is probably healthy researching and thinking about the politics of things like the RPP sentence. And I just mentioned that because it seems a good example of a general question that we could raise, which is really, in broad terms, whether the parole process is about driving rehabilitation, which speaks to some of what's been said, or is it about primarily ensuring incapacitory public protection? Now, I say the RPP is a good example, because it's a good example where those two things are treated as if they are mutually supportive and they can both run at the same time. In terms of thinking about reshaping parole, I wonder whether you would agree, or whether one of those things needs to take priority, for example, or whether we simply need to conceive it in a different way altogether.
Thank you. The third question in this set is from you in the tie there. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Simon Crichton. I'm a solicitor who's been acting at parole hearings for 25 years. Unusually, I quite agree with what Nick said, and normally, and not with Nikki, but I'd just like to. I'd like to ask the panel. I'd just like to ask the panel about the recall situation, because I think the burden of proof at parole board hearings, when you're talking about risk assessment, is incredibly difficult to pin down. And as somebody a lawyer who very rarely disagrees with Lord Bingham, he actually said that in a case that he's not sure it has a place in parole hearings. But I think there is a distinction at recall hearings, which are often incredibly fact-specific. And if you look at parole board rules in other jurisdictions, particularly in lots of American states, they have very perfunctory sets of rules for first release. But on recall, they're very strong on evidence procedure, and they specifically put the burden of proof on the recalling officer to establish that the recall's necessary. And I just wonder what the panel think about trialling that as a way of seeing whether the burden of proof actually works in this process, where it's most critical at the moment.
That's great. Thank you.
Okay, if I can go first. Catherine's question, mental health issues, probably the best case I saw was somebody who was with a mental health pathway, and actually enormous support. Once you had that label and that diagnosis, he was... One of the things which really impressed me was the prison staff were going to go out into the next place where he was going to live, be with him and be supportive. So the help that you can get when you have the label was, to me, surprising, because I thought my sympathy would be entirely with you in saying that this is a big problem. People don't get the support, but some people do get mental health support.
That's what I hear all the time with people that have got learning difficulties. And I think it's because they are not spotted. And that's the problem.
And your other point was about the police station, and everybody must agree with you that people need much better advice and support in the prison system. Harry, I think the question for you is to, when you say about, is the parole process about driving rehabilitation or public protection, you're asking some really fundamental questions about life sentences and why we have them. Personally, I don't mind having life sentences. I wouldn't abolish them completely as long as we have a system that gets people out promptly and that tariffs don't get longer and longer and. The safeguards have got to be enormous, which is where I move on to Simon, which is, if you think the burden of proof is important for recall, I can't see why you don't think it is post-tariff. You are a fundamentally different person once you're post-tariff. It's like being recalled. It's exactly the same as being recalled, except you've never been out.
So it's about the nature of the process that's undertaken. At the first release, risk assessment is very different from factual assessments, which happens on recall, and that's why it's difficult, even if you're post-tariff, because it's still about that risk assessment.
Yeah. Any other comments from the panel?
Well, just to pick up, don't really disagree much. I mean, one about Catherine's point, which echoes what I said. I think, first of all, there's the issue by which people with mental health issues of a wide variety get into the criminal justice system in the first place. And I think one of the good things in the Queen's speech, if I understand it correctly, is there was a commitment to do something about mental health in the criminal justice system, if nothing else. Whether how that materialised would be difficult to see. But a really big issue...
It's because their family got
selected. Well, but a really big issue as well is getting people out. So when you have people with, say, very chaotic behaviour, who's maybe very difficult to manage in the community, and you see panels, they're just trying to find somewhere for them to go. An example I've been talking about recently is men with early onset dementia, right? Where actually one of the consequences of the dementia is their behaviour deteriorates, right? But actually you try and find a residential home for the elderly that's prepared to have this guy where when visitors come you've got to shut him in his room. That's a really hard thing to do. So I've said this to my sisters, and I'll say them again, if you've got a capital budget, don't spend it on all of it on prisons, but spend some of it on providing things, a better range of approved premises or support for people once they're released.
I mean, probation as well.
Just let me answer some of the other questions, right? Then just on Harry's point, look, my view is if people don't need to be incarcerated, don't incarcerate them, right? I have a sort of doubt about the whole sort of rehabilitation thing. I think prisons do quite well if they don't make people worse. You know, that's... don't put people in prison to rehabilitate them. Put them in prison because that's how society's decided they should be punished, or because society needs to be protected from them. When they're there, if you do a bit of good, that's good. Try and minimise the harm. But I would argue prisons are antithetical to the rehabilitation nature. You know, it's hard to think of a less rehabilitative place than prisons, frankly. So you can limit the damage. You can try and limit the damage that some prisons do, but don't do that. And there are some sort of... I think, look, without getting into the detail, I think recall is the big issue. Actually, I understood that too late, I think. And there's a whole range of things about how the hearings work, about, you know, who should be making recall decisions, who should be making release decisions, etc., etc. And I certainly think, given the numbers, if you want to have impact, you know, go back to your nudge, that's what I would be doing, a lot of nudging, because I think that's the one that will get people who shouldn't be in prison out of prison most quickly, I think.
Great. Laura, do you have anything to say?
Just a few comments, I think, on the mental health thing. It's an incredibly important issue. I think, obviously, you know, there are many people stuck in our prisons who ought to be better placed in hospitals. That brings with it its own huge array of problems. I think the really difficult one, really difficult situation is those who fall in between the two. You can't cope in prison but don't meet the criteria for hospital.
Yeah.
But, and I think then, again, much more active use of the community care rights. It's a lot of the work that the Howard League team do is sort of trying to really get the statutory agencies to put in to place those kinds of placements so that they can be managed properly.
Sorry to interrupt, we just have a lot of other questions.
In terms of the intermediaries issue that you raise, again, really important, something that my colleagues in the legal team of the Howard League have done, in fact, is actually had intermediaries along to parole hearings, because it's actually really, really important. It's very unusual. I don't think I've come across many people doing it, but it makes a huge difference, because otherwise you're layering misunderstanding upon misunderstanding, and I think that's something that MCA members ought to actively consider when they're making their directions. In relation to the sort of rehabilitation versus sort of, the, you know, safety, you know, sort of containing the risk, I do think generally, in most cases, not all of them, they're two sides of the same coin, and so I don't feel it's too mutually exclusive. And in terms of Simon's point, who of course always has the best ideas, I think is a really interesting idea. I think it's something that is worth a try. Actually, my one concern about it would be on the ground that again this feeling of it becoming a really stressful adversarial process, and then that person, if they win it, having to be managed by that person, but. I still think, you know, and I think the idea also of accountability for recall is really important. Yeah.
Thank you. Next round of questions, and again, can I please remind you to keep your questions brief so that we can have time for as many. The first one is you here. Second is you right there, and then in the back. So front row first. Do you pass the mic down? Yep.
Next time.
Hi there, Tom Guiney from the LSE. One of the things that really interests me about parole is that the way people tend to talk about it is as an inversion of the reason why people are sent into prison in the first place. And if you look at the history of the parole board, it strikes me that it's kind of pendulum swung from a very optimistic indeterminacy in the early days in the 60s through to a sort of just deserts focus in the 90s and back to a sort of indeterminacy based on dangerousness and a sort of pessimism. And I just wonder to what extent it would be a good move to go back towards a more determinate sentencing regime, so that parole is a more positive enterprise of the state trying to prove why someone should be released earlier than the date set by the courts, rather than at the moment what strikes me as a sort of negative exercise of trying to prove why they are no longer a risk. So I wonder if a determinacy in sentencing might be a kind of important step towards reform.
Thank you. I think it's going down, yep.
Hello, Helen Boothman from Independent Monitor at Little Hay Prison and also the Association of Independent Monitors. If I may, just very, very quickly, just two comments, not two questions. One comment is we had a training visit recently to a prison where there is hope, and I just wanted to share that, and that place is called Warren Hill, where they are practicing a progressive regime, and their figures and everything about that place is about release, and the whole prison is focused on getting prisoners out that door, and even so much so that they're even talking about putting an approved premises on the location there. So that was just a sharing that. And the second one is a question, really, just thinking about some of the specific offenders that the parole board see. Do you think you need specialist parole board members? And here I'm thinking about sex offenders, where you have different risk assessments, you have courses that people don't understand, whether they're successful or not, and you have the whole issue of deniers. Are they increased risk or not? And I just wondered what your views were on that.
Great, thanks. And finally, this gentleman in the back. Hand raised.
My name is... Hello, can you hear me? My name is Stephen Breslin, and this is part of a kind of fact-finding mission, because there are a group of us here who are about to embark on a befriending scheme with prisoners who will be released. I won't say which prison we're at. A couple of things. One of the questions I wanted to ask the panel was, is there a point at which the parole service was seen to be working in the way that it was originally set up? Can you identify a point at which things started to, shall we say, unravel or gum up? Or is this just an organic process? My second question is there a difference in terms of how the parole board behaves vis-a-vis females versus male prisoners? Is there anything that the academics have looked at on that? And my third, and this is really a point for Nick Hardwick, was your comment about trying to reset the narrative for how we describe the process of parole and what the parole board does. That struck me very hard, because as somebody's come into this arena where one's surrounded by specialists, I think to the normal person outside when they hear, and he was released on parole, they think they know what that means, when in fact the general public probably has no real idea about what the specialists are talking about. And I think that what you said about the victim, the National Victims Association, having broadly the same questions of a lack of empowerment is, you know, really quite interesting. You have to reset the narrative. My final observation is I'd love to see how this audience would look like if it was a bunch of people who were parolees, what their views would be.
That's very good. Thank you. Any responses from the panel?
Who do you want to go first?
You're welcome to go first.
Tom, interesting question about optimism in the 1960s, and interesting questions about when there was a good time and so on. I think it's really interesting that the penal culture was so different, and the mood of the nation, whatever that means, the role of the media. I think the parole board, again, we said in our talks that the parole board is a tiny bit in a great big penal justice system, but actually you raise something even bigger, and I'll say no more about that. Helen will all agree with you about Warren Hill, but of course it's very depressing that they've got to Warren Hill in the first place, because why hadn't they got out from where they were before they got to Warren Hill? So Warren Hill is a beacon of hope in a depressing world. Specialist members, I think, is really interesting. The parole board's latest recruitment was for people who were prepared to give about half time to being on the parole board, largely not experts, certainly not criminologists, and you have to give about half time of your time to it for an uncertain income. You can do really, really well, but you can't be sure that how much work you'll be doing. And I think the nature of who becomes a parole board member is a really interesting question. And Stephen's question I'm going to leave to Nick to answer.
Very quickly, my answers. I mean, I think Tom about a more positive atmosphere. I think you should talk to Harry, because it's about the politics, actually, some of this. And this links a bit also to what Stephen was asking about. When was the parole board, which people sometimes blend it up with the probation service, it's not the same thing. It was knocked off, of course, when the number of cases, it's like the prison service, number of cases rose, we had to do more hearings, do more staff intensive, and the number of members we had to do hearings reduced. So backlogs grew. That was very demoralising for people. They got beaten up by the politicians of the time. And it is more positive now, but it's not a surprise what happened there, I think. And the critical thing about the numbers is now we are getting our actual resources are more in line with the work. It's not merely that we can process more cases, but there is more opportunity now to think about how we're processing cases, what we're doing, this kind of the training development of members is important. Warren Hill is excellent, and actually, interestingly, Warren Hill is releasing more people than people who are going through the rotten process in other ways. I mean, I think some very big lessons to learn about from Warren Hill. The thing that strikes about Warren Hill is how enthusiastic the staff are. They say to you, this is what I joined the prison service to do. It kind of works. So there are lessons to be learned from that. Specialist members, I mean, I suppose we would argue we do have specialist members. We are specialising more and more, actually, But we have our guests on a case with sex offenders would be likely to use a psychologist, psychiatrist members quite often, and they would have a specialist expertise in this area. So we would use specialists, I think, quite a lot. And then just in terms of Stephen's point, I mean, I think, your point about the feet of the women prisoners, one thing that's really striking about the problem is about how little research has been done recently. So what are the needs of women prisoners? We don't know. And that would be, we're looking at potential research options for that. We've got some stuff in training. There's a whole lot about the parole system and how it works. We simply don't know. And your point about the narrative is correct. I think it's important that we aren't, you know, doing this thing about talking to ourselves, but talking to people who've got ideas about the system. And one thing I think that people... just one other point, just because then I'll probably shut up for the evening, two things I think that are really worth saying. I thought when I took on my job, I was appointed on the basis they wanted somebody independent, and they thought that somebody completely ignorant would fit the bill, really. So I got appointed on the basis I was completely ignorant. And if you look at the parole system, I thought it would be about either, if you look on you just Google parole, right? In America, it tends to be about forgiveness. Has this person done long enough now that we can sort of forgive what they did? or people think often it's about what the prisoner has done. The prisoners have behaved well enough to earn release. And rather than my surprise, I find it's not about that really at all. It's about what the system has done to the prisoner, which is where the random process kicks in. So, you know, you might have a course done to you, or you might not, depending on what prison you're in. And that's what seems to me, there's a randomness of it sometimes, is very unfair. And I think it's, people have no idea how it works, and that creates a whole set of issues, and we need to talk to those people.
Sorry, I think we need to take one last set of questions. Nikki has indicated...
I wanted to say something, is that okay? I won't answer all of them, but in terms of specialist members... I think the membership is a really important question, and I think there are some great specialist members, but I do still think that there doesn't seem to be huge diversity on the parole board, and I do think the appointment of the parole board, you know, I'm not so worried about the Queensland Gate address, I was rather shocked when I first heard of it at the time, but I do think the Ministry of Justice involvement in appointing parole board members is a real problem for independents, actually.
Thank you. He's indicated that she'd rather hear more from you than take the last few minutes to sum up, so I think
we took on 57 parole members just recently. How diverse are they?
Wait, no, we're going to take a few other questions and then maybe you can chat afterwards, because we have run over time. We started 5 minutes late, so I'm happy to let us end 5 minutes late. But brief as you can possibly be, you down in the front and you right there in the back. Yeah.
Let's finish it. Phil had his hand up.
And Phil, did you have your hand up? I didn't see it up this time.
I'm Stephen Shute. I've written quite a lot on parole, and this is obviously a very rich discussion, and there are a huge number of different issues that I'd like to talk about, but I can't because the time is limited. I mean, the first thing, I wanted to say something about determinacy and indeterminacy. We've got much, much more determinacy around than we used to have. I mean, the parole system used to engage almost all prisoners who were serving sentences of any length of time when it began, and it doesn't now. So it's really actually operating on the indeterminate end of the system. I think if you... I'll put in heretical thought. I wonder whether the move now to make the system more court-like has actually been counterproductive. I mean, you've got a system now that is quite elaborate. It's riddled with delays. It's always been riddled with delays. Pretty much since the parole system began, delays have been an issue. But because we've got such an elaborate decision-making mechanism, it's hard, although I know Nick was expressing some optimism about delays coming down, it's hard to see those delays being eliminated. And I do wonder whether we actually need to start to think again, and especially if we've got to the point where, as Nick was indicating, indicating, and I don't know the latest figures, but if we're now getting 75% positive decisions on IPPs, have we reached the point where we need such an elaborate system to produce 75% positive decisions? Could we find a more streamlined approach if such positivity is going to come out of it? I mean, just a couple of other things.
Maybe just one other
specialist
thing.
Specialist members. Okay. I mean, that has switched very dramatically. There are five statutory categories that the legislation laid down for the composition of the parole board, but independent members now dominate. Although you've got many more judicial members, funnily enough, than you used to have, and that's been an encouraging trend. Actually, it used to be hard to get judges to agree to serve on the parole board. Now that has fallen away. And I think I agree entirely about the concentration on the recall side of it. If you're going to streamline it elsewhere, but keep the recalls with quite a lot of due process.
Thank you. Really brief question.
Is it on? Okay. I'm Constance Adeyemi, and I'm just here as a member of the public interested in crime and how it affects people. My question is about a multidisciplinary approach to support in the community. So I don't know much about the probation system, but it strikes me as being quite administrative, and people who come out often have complex needs, maybe emotional immaturity, for lack of a better term, or education or jobs, or, you know, just integrating back into society, and probation doesn't seem to be equipped to do that. But I might be wrong in that, and I stand corrected.
Thank you. And you wanted to hear a question from one other? Yeah, okay. So the last word, and then each respondent has 30 seconds to respond.
I wonder whether we've... Sorry, I'm Phil Weekly. I used to work in the prison system, and I represent myself, nobody else. I wonder whether we've worked out how we're going to address the political issues of risk. The system tightened up when John Reid, who was then the minister, addressed the parole board and said there'd been a high-profile failure, you mustn't do that again. And actually, the release rate for life has halved at that point. Mm-hmm. Just went off a cliff. It's never really picked up properly since then. And risk is what drives everybody, because they're worried about being blamed. That's why offender managers are very reluctant to have people out. They're high risk. If it goes wrong, they'll get blamed. If it goes right, nobody will praise them a lot. And they're also inclined to get them back in custody, because that's safer than leaving them out for their careers. So trying to find a way in which we can accept more risk, or if we can't, at least accept that the politics mean that we can't do it. And how do we manage that? If you know the answer to that, you can make a real difference.
And if you know the answer to that in 30 seconds, even better.
I want to answer Stephen Shute's question about whether making it more court-like had been counterproductive by asking Bernard Richmond QC to answer the question, because he was looking apoplectic at the question. So what is your answer to Stephen, Bernard?
If you... Briefly.
Is making it court-like a good thing?
Yeah, I'm actually going to be brief, because I'm not being paid. In courts, we have a system now where people have to be trained to deal with vulnerable people, to ask short questions, to know what they're doing, and to be trained. The parole system, as far as I understand it, has no such training. You have disempowered... Well, there's no formal vulnerable witness training, as far as I understand it. You've got disempowered people who can't articulate themselves in what is a very formal situation, being asked to explain themselves. And I think the parole board actually needs to look at the special measures that are put in for complainants, and to put something very similar in, so that it is a more tribunal-like, informal environment where the person who's trying to justify why they should be released feels able to communicate. And that may mean not actually in the panel room, but somewhere having some sort of interview.
I don't know whether you've been to a parole hearing.
I've suffered them, yeah.
Right. Well, generally I would say they are pretty, in my experience of them, the ones I've been to, is that they are informal. Actually, they aren't. They are an informal setting, partly in the way you described. I mean, you could argue, actually, they were too informal. Don't disagree about training people to do stuff. And as I said, now we've got more resources, we can do some of that. I'll just answer, as I'm speaking, just answer two points. One is about Stephen's point. I think part of the way to address what you're saying I think the parole board takes lots of decisions it doesn't need to take. I think some of these decisions could be taken in the executive, maybe with a right of appeal to the parole board or whatever. I actually think you could get rid of a lot of stuff off the parole board's agenda myself, and it would be better taken by people, as you say, in a way who actually know the prisoner in a way that last question was saying. On your point about, just on Phil's point about risk, if I just address, your point about probation, I agree with that. I think that's a big problem. You only have to see the report today around the problems there. On Phil's point about risk, I'm absolutely, I think that's right. That's why I try to talk about it. I think part of the way you'd address that is by saying concern.